This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Hey, I'd like to begin this podcast by thanking all of you listeners each week for coming and listening to the different guests that we have here on The Magic Word. It's a lot of fun to put these things together and to talk to a lot of friends and to share the stories with all the rest of you. In particular, I want to thank the friends of The Magic Word who have given their financial support. And I want to thank a recent friend of The Magic Word, Mr. Thomas Fraps from Germany. Yes, we have listeners from all over the world and supporters as well, and you could be a supporter if you would like to give your financial support through a one-time donation via PayPal, or you can go to patreon.com/themagicword and learn more information about how that you can become an ongoing supporter by pledging your monthly pledge. Our guest today is Mr. Scott Hollingsworth. Some of you may recognize the name, but others may not. He was the entertainment director for a long number of years at the Magic Island here in Houston, Texas. The Magic Island, of course, was a club that was open to the public, which was unlike the Magic Castle. The Magic Castle is an exclusive club for members only of the Academy of Magical Arts. The Magic Island was a nightclub that was open to the public that first started in California, and then later came to Houston with a plan to expand into the rest of the U.S. into some other major cities, but never went into those places, which we'll get into during this podcast. Scott Hollingsworth was not only the entertainment director for a number of years, but in the early years when they first opened, was one of the house magicians at the Magic Island. And in this podcast, he talks a lot about some of the people who had come in, some of the stories that were quite interesting about some of the psychics, some of the guests who had come in, as well as many of the performers who were here during that time. And this particular podcast about the Magic Island will give you a little bit more insight to some behind-the-scenes kind of information that's happened at the Magic Island over the 25 years. I did a video on the Magic Island, which I posted on YouTube, and that has received a lot of hits. And in fact, the podcast for the Magic Island has had more downloads than any single podcast over the last nearly 300 that I have posted over the past several years. And there wasn't a lot of information in that other than just a link to a video on YouTube that I mentioned that would show the guided tour by Scott Hollingsworth of the Magic Island. If you're interested in, after you've listened to the podcast, if you've not seen the video, then I suggest that you go ahead and you can click on the information here on the podcast website at themagicwordpodcast.com, and there you'll be able to watch a behind-the-scenes look at what the Magic Island used to look like. This was filmed many years ago, I want to say probably around 2007, so it was about a year before the hurricane had come through and closed the Magic Island. Well, enough for me, so let's hear from the other Scott, Mr. Scott Hollingsworth, here on the Magic Word Podcast. Hello, this is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and today it gives me a great pleasure to welcome my guest, Mr. Scott Hollingsworth. Hey there, Scotto.
Hey, how's it going, Scott?
Very good, and it's kind of funny, Scott and Scott, so
yeah. We've been living with that for years.
We have, haven't we? Yeah. That you've gone by Scotto for so long. Have you been known as Scotto since you were a kid, or just really since you were doing magic?
Well, I started when I was doing a television program. I was hired to do a birthday party in what they would call their green room. Yeah. And so I was a clown. And
with makeup and
with
everything?
With makeup, the whole bit. Mm-hmm. White face, big red nose.
Red nose, yeah.
A pointed hat and spots all over my suit. And the lady says, well, what is your name? And I said, well, just Mr. Clown. She says, no, I like Scotto the Clown. And that's where the word Scotto
and
came
stuck from there.
Yeah.
Well, that is funny. Kind of like Bozo, Scotto.
Yeah, Scotto. Okay, yeah, that's you. Where it came from.
Okay, well, I'll be doggone. And so you obviously developed from there. And how old were you when you did that?
I did that.
Teenager?
Yeah, I was a teenager. I was about 17, 18 years old.
Yeah,
and it was this one summer. Uh-huh. And they called and said, Howard Campbell had told him that Howard Campbell, who owned Howard Fun Shop in Houston, he called me on the phone and said, I told Lady down Channel 13 that you're going to, they'll be calling you, and they just want you to come in and do some clown magic. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't do clowns. He said, well, do a clown. Get your suit. And so I went and bought me a clown suit right off the rack, and put a little red hat and a rubber nose, and there I went.
And did some clown bits. Yeah, I mean, you hadn't been, studied as a clown.
No study at all.
And were you doing magic tricks also?
Yeah, I was doing magic tricks. I was doing
but just in the clown outfit.
Yeah, as I always say, the first 13 pages out of Abbott's catalog, you know.
Kind of funny. Well, as we kind of get started, just to kind of give everybody a brief background, I guess, on who Scott Hollingsworth is, because we have international listeners and others may not know the name immediately, and others who do know you, of course, are saying, hey, I really want to know more about this guy. But, of course, best known as being the entertainment director for the Magic Island here in Houston, and been involved performing since the first day that it opened, and was there and associated with it for 25 years, from day one to day end, all the way through. And beyond that, of course, then as a coach and director that you do, and a teacher, and but really haven't had an opportunity really to travel around the world or across the states because of your obligation with the island for so many years that you were here. So I know you've been out to the castle and performed a few times since the island has closed, and because you didn't have an opportunity during the time, you know.
I think one time.
Just
the
one time?
Yeah, just the one time I went. I went once before the island opened, and then after the island opened, I took a leave of absence 4 days.
Well, it seems to me that during the time of the Magic Island that one of the owners, David Ahmed, did he go with you one time because they were thinking about having the seance room opened up or something?
Yes.
And
is
that right?
That's right. He went out there to I'd talk to him about the amount of money, because that's all they would listen to.
Yeah.
You can talk about profit and you can talk about them making some money. Then I was telling them how much more we could make by having seances.
Yeah.
Charging a meal and seance room. And that perked his interest, and he went out to California and visited out there for a week and got some ideas on it and came back.
Yeah. And nothing ever happened.
Well, I hired the psychic out of Arizona.
Lee Earle?
Lee Earle.
Yeah.
To come in and give me a quote.
Yeah.
And he did. Gave me an excellent quote, well written, well versed on what the castle was doing, what he was doing, and his small seance room.
Yeah, manifestations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And really gave what I thought a professional and a presentation that was well documented and read, comparing prices, what California income, his income and his place, and the Houston income. And it narrowed down that we would make a great deal of money if we went with our seance room. However, once the idea that we had to spend about $10,000 to soundproof that room, it became nil and void, shall we say.
In other words, that he didn't want to invest in
money. Originally, our seance room at Magic Island was built for seance room.
Well, that's what I thought. And didn't Kerry Pollack put some things in the walls and all that
stuff? No, it wasn't him. It was somebody out of the castle area, but it wasn't Kerry.
Someone else in L.A.?
Yeah, in L.A. that had worked out some of the seance spooky things that were going on once the lights were out. But the problem was... It had a hanging ceiling.
Right.
And so the acoustics was not great at all.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You could hear all the acoustics coming out of the theater, out in the hallways.
In the restaurant.
So one of the things that Lee Earle first, right off the bat, said it would have to be soundproof.
Makes sense,
and, so that was going to take the large amount of that money. And in doing so, that sort of came with a
thud. That's
why I'm,
exactly. So that was a no-go from there.
No-go. But I really appreciate what he did. And
and they never did any seances in there, did they?
Never.
Okay. Not even an impromptu? I mean, no one ever officially did
anything. The only thing that anything like that would ever took place in there was palm readers. Palm readers would go in. Because the room was built for 12 people.
12 people.
And you could have one table at the end to have the 13th person. That was
one
where
chair,
the reader
right.
was. Well... Instead of them using it as a seance room, they used it strictly as a small banquet. Parties of 10, 8, people who wanted to pay an extra amount of money could get this private room, very, very lavishly decored. And they made a lot of money off of just banquets in there, just small banquets. And then they would have the psychics come in and do psychic readings, but never a seance.
Yeah. Well, when the Magic Island first opened, of course, it was a private club, and it was built upon the idea that there would be a chain of these, starting with the one that was out in Long Beach, I guess. Yes. Isn't there a mountain?
Newport Beach.
Newport Beach, yes.
Newport Beach was the pioneer or the first location. And Michael Cayley and his group of investors, along with Dr. Albo, put that together. They were short a little amount of money. I don't know exactly, maybe $300,000, something like that. So they came to some friends here in the Houston area. Mm-hmm. And the Houston area said, we'll be more than happy to invest in your program if you'll put the flagship here in Houston.
Okay.
And you build us a flagship where we can model it and sell off of it. Because the one in Newport wasn't really that big other than just a strip center.
I was going to say, that was part of
it. Just a strip center. Right on the pier, the yacht pier.
Right.
And it didn't have the essence that they wanted to have to sell it franchise. And within a short period of time, after Magic Island opened, and before they decided to do anything else, they had about four cities in line that people had already paid deposits for. Denver, Colorado was one.
Oh, really?
And someplace up in Ohio had done some bidding.
Yeah.
And
I thought they were going to go like Atlanta, Chicago, Washington, D.C., or kind of.
They were going to go to the major cities because it was a traffic draw. You had to have traffic and
tourist.
You had to have tourists.
Yeah.
And that's was their original plan. In fact, in all the promotional programs that we went out to and pitched the private club in the Houston area, we talked about it being a franchise that would originate out of Houston, and it had six cities that were involved in opening up within the next year. And that's sort of our sales pitch that we had in presenting it to the
investors.
Okay.
So you were involved with Michael Cayley when you went around to these investors, the individuals or corporations or who?
They were corporations that we were selling memberships to first, and then they were talking about we even have bigger plans, and that we would sure like to talk to anyone who would be interested in helping us further this franchise clause. Now you got to remember that was in the late 79s, early 80s, 82, 83, 84 is when we were pushing and promoting Magic Island here in the greater Houston area. And because I was a magician and because I was going to be the resident magician at that time, I would go out and whet the appetite, do a little magic, stand-up magic, parlor-type magic. And then after about 15 minutes, introduce the girl, very, very attractive girl, to do a pitch. And then they brought in the technical financial person. I don't remember his name right off. But that's how it sort of went. We went as a three-man team.
Oh, okay.
And we called on, maybe 10, 15 places around Houston.
Yeah. And did many of them sign up at that point?
Well, we had a lot of members. We had over 2,400 members had paid for members in a neighborhood of $3,000 to $5,000.
Yeah.
So there was a great deal of money collected for private club membership at that time.
Yeah. Well, at that time, I remember I had a magician's membership, which was a little bit less than that. And I was living in Midland at the time, and I came and joined and traveled back and forth from time to time and brought some of my clients in there. And I recall that in the initial days that in one of the bars that they had a little three-piece band or a little jazz band, and even in the afternoon they'd have happy hour and when it was for a private club. And then in the evening, one of the restaurant areas would turn into a nightclub and had a disco ball and a DJ and everything like that.
Yeah. All that was taking place. It was in the early 80s, so disco was very heavy in those days.
Right.
The three-piece band was that elegant band that came in on Saturdays and Sunday nights, you know, where music was real soft and neat. On the Saturday nights, they were there early till about 9 o'clock. And then when the last show let out at 11 o'clock, then the disco kicked in.
Yeah.
And so it was a mecca for entertainment dollar value.
Yeah.
The not only did you have first-class magic shows on the stage, an auditorium that seat anywhere from 100 150 to 175 if you want to crowd everybody in. Mm-hmm. But we also had a parlor theater called Cleopatra's Chamber. It seat 100 people. Mm-hmm. Plus, we had two excellent close-up rooms where we had, during that period of time, we had four magicians. Mm-hmm. One was a visiting close-up magician, people such as Daryl Martinez, Paul Harris, you just name them. They were there at one time for a week as a close-up celebrity. Mm-hmm. And then myself, Bill Arnold, and Kent Bingham were the we were the three resident magicians that were there all the time doing close-up magic. So the plus we had the psychics, the palm readers, fun blackjack, and the disco and a piano bar. So it was all you could go any place. All that stuff going on, and that was a really a swinging club.
It was a lot of fun, and because it was for members only and it was exclusive, a lot of people, I'm sure, wanted to get in, and the only way you could is if you were a guest of a member. Mm-hmm. So they had guest cards they were giving out at that time. The problem was that it opened shortly before the bust in the economy of the, with Houston being a energy capital of the world, and when energy prices crashed, I remember back at that time there was a restaurant here in town that used to have their luncheon that was pegged to the price of oil. So whatever the oil price was, that'd be the price of lunch. I remember one day it was $11.57 or something. I mean, it was fairly inexpensive for a barrel of oil, you know, back then. Not that it's much more now. It seems like, you know, it's not even $50 a barrel. But the point is that as a result of that, that the original idea of thinking that a lot of companies would have their they'd have an expense account, and they would have people coming in, and unfortunately that didn't quite pan out, just timing-wise.
One of the things about it, the timing was excellent. They hit it right when the oil boom was going. Everybody, all the oil companies, and as you know, Houston being an oil capital at that time, money was not an issue. And they would buy a membership for $5,000, but 15 members could come in, you know, during that period of time. And it was... it was really a plus factor because the building alone, just the building alone, was $6.5 million just for the building, not including all that interior that they had going on. So it basically was a really great venue here in the city of Houston, none other like it at all. Because we were the only live entertainment that a company could bring their employees out to. And with that in mind, it blossomed well. It just really, really did well.
For a short time. And, you know, I mean, obviously that would have
when
stayed.
When the boom hit, when that boom hit, it took us about 2 years to realize that everybody wanted to cash in their memberships, did not want any new members. We just wasn't getting any new members. They wanted to sell their memberships off. So it really became a problem. And that's when Dr. Albo and Michael Cayley, these were the original investors from Newport Beach. They're the ones that started looking around for a buyer. And the buyer that they found was a doctor here in Houston, which was a very popular doctor. And he really loved magic, and he enjoyed bringing his clients out to Magic Island. So Dr. Albo and Dr. Atari got together and made a deal. And there was a transition period in there from about 6 months that we were closed because of changing of management, tax purposes and all, from California taxes to Houston taxes. It was... some kind of law that said that you had to be closed 30 days. And so we were closed there about that period of time. But when we opened back up under a new regime, under David Ahmed and Dr. Atari, we were still blowing and going. We were still with the fact that we were still on that edge.
On the peak of that bell curve.
And it all worked out real well for another 5 to 6 years. And because then... we came in with when they came in with the idea of not being a private club, but that of a public open to the public. Right. Anybody could come.
Right.
Anybody could come. Well, we then had a problem with all those members who still had memberships.
Yeah.
And they were wanting us to buy back the membership because they bought a private club membership and now it's open to the public.
Right. Right.
Anybody can come. And it was a big hassle. Big, big hassle right. for a long time.
Let me go back just sure. a little bit to the mm-hmm. beginning of whenever that it was being built. Mm-hmm. And I remember it being stripped down just to the bare girders, basically, on mm-hmm. that property. And it had been other kinds of places in the past. Right. It had been a business facility, I mean, a business office. And it was
Moore's Office Supply.
Moore's Office Supply. Then it was a nightclub, mm-hmm. I think, for a while.
Nautilus Center.
That's Nautilus Center.
Nautilus Center.
Workout.
Glasses crawl right by the road. You could see people working out.
Yeah, by the freeway.
Mm-hmm. And they closed, and it became Elage.
That was it.
Mm-hmm. Elage was the name of the
disco
the midnight club that opened up there. Yeah. And then Elage got in a problem, and they closed it. Mm-hmm. And then Magic Island people came in, ripped the sidings all off, and built the facade that you now see on the building. And just made it into a wonderful place.
Right, yeah. It was beautiful, certainly. Beautiful. Kind of a truncated pyramid style. And as far as some of the trappings on the inside that were built, as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was by a fella who had done some special effects and working with Indiana Jones mm-hmm. In the Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, some of the
correct.
Paintings and things. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Now, his name, I'm going to kind of miss it a little bit, is Mark, first name, Von Frautenberg.
Okay.
And he was a engineer designer for the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mm-hmm. And when Michael Caley and Dr. Alboa contacted him, he came to Houston and sort of put some of that same flair of the dungeons and the spiders and the snakes and all of that into the decor here, which the Egyptian decor.
Yeah.
And worked right in with the theme of magic. So it just really...
Well, they also
really
carried it on from the one in Newport Beach because, as I recall, again, back in the 70s when King Tut exhibit had first mm-hmm. come through, that they had, after it left, that there were a lot of exhibits or mm-hmm. Things that promoted it, like the sarcophagus and whatever.
Those.
And so these things were cheap that museums were getting rid of, and they thought, well, okay, well, it has a theme of magic. I should say relationship, I guess.
History
of that. So they kind of had that. So this carried on that Egyptian theme.
Yeah, right.
The one here.
So.
And that was the whole idea for the rest of the franchise. Had they completed that, would have continued that same thing.
Continued that.
Okay.
They had a warehouse full of this particular
Egyptian
artifacts.
Right, right.
And when they finished the building, about four semi-trucks pulled up at Magic Island's parking lot.
Wow.
And they started unloading all of these paintings and statues and, mm-hmm. As you know, couple of them that stood out by the door were like 10 feet tall, 7 feet long, and I mean wide, and just humongous statues. So it really put a great, elegant look
very
of the Egyptian
so, yeah.
period.
Mm-hmm. Big, beautiful brass doors mm-hmm. and everything as you would come in then as well. And I can see the influence, certainly, of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, because when you would come in after that, you would check in, you would have your card you'd put in the snake's mouth. It would be like a big brass mm-hmm. coiled cobra, and you put then the doors would open.
Right. That card, it was a credit card size, but it was your membership card.
Membership card, yeah.
Right. And it was so keyed by the magnetic strip that when you put the card into the mouth of the cobra, mm-hmm. the eyes would light up of the cobra, and a puff of smoke would come up, and the door behind the snake would open up, mm-hmm. and you would go around the snake and into the door. That took you upstairs.
Well, take us on a little tour. So that's kind of what happened.
Oh, sure.
So the door,
mm-hmm.
so the doors would open, and then you kind of walk into what?
Right, you walked into a dungeon where you saw mummies and ancient miners trying to dig and excavate.
Excavate
all
these
the
archaeologists,
ruins.
Kind of, yeah.
Right. And then you stepped out of that room into an elevator mm-hmm. that was sort of like it was gray, steel-like, and
it's like a vault almost.
A vault. And you went in it, and it took you to the second floor. But as you was going up, you had water on one side, like you were in the Amazon River type of thing, mm-hmm. or Nile.
Nile.
And then basically cobra snakes were weaving outside this plate glass,
yeah.
and jewelry and all kind of gold bars and all was packed in the back area, so that person looking through the windows would think that it was a lost mine of
right.
some type.
That you found something, yeah. because actually, although you were going up, it made you feel as if you were going down.
Uh-huh.
In other words, that they had discovered this lost world below the Magic Island. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was really.
And then once the doors open, you would descend upon the Garden of Nefertiti.
Yeah, Nefertiti's, and you walk out of this humongous lounge that had just beautiful decor.
Yeah,
padded seats, upholstered everything, and the walls were velour green.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, makes me wish we were still there.
Isn't that true? Yes, that's right. Very nostalgic here,
yeah.
for sure. Now, I think an amazing thing is, of course, that when people would often go in, it's you always got the same comments as if you're going into Doctor Who's TARDIS. It's right. larger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Yeah,
it was like 10,000 square feet or so.
Right.
But you
18,000 feet.
Holy
that
cow!
That included the bottom floor,
downstairs, yeah.
downstairs as well as that upstairs
yeah.
second layer.
Yeah. But the way that it was laid out so that you had all these smaller rooms, as you mentioned, the close-up mm-hmm. rooms, as well as Cleopatra's Chamber and Palace of Tutankhamen and all the rest of these areas that seemed all intimate, that one room kind of led to another, and it was mm-hmm. Very fantastic. Continuing, though, with the motif, when you would walk down the hallway into the Cleopatra's Chamber, which was originally designed as being the parlor, if you will, comparable to the Magic Island's castle parlor, that would seat about, what, 130 people or so?
About 150.
Okay.
A lot of people would be standing around the blackjack tables and yeah. around the psychic, so you could put about 150 people in there.
Okay. And the hieroglyphics, if you will, there mm-hmm. were some beautiful paintings on the walls that told the life of Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm.
Richard,
yep.
Can you tell a little bit about that, or who did that?
Yeah. They had commissioned the art department for Rice University here in Houston they brought in these large Egyptian books that were really, the
Some
pages were like 32 by 40 page books.
Wow.
And they had these beautiful pictures of all the ruins of art decor from the Egyptian period of time.
Uh-huh.
And they had pictures of the actual walls of some of the
pyramids. Yeah.
And so the art students projected those pictures from the book.
Onto the walls. Yeah.
And they spent about 1 month
uh-huh.
painting these pictures just exactly like they were
in the book.
These big books they had. And they used a projection type of picture.
Mm-hmm.
And there would one person would come by and mark it if it was blue or red or green.
Uh-huh.
And they would put a code down. So mm-hmm. they wanted to make sure it stayed as original to the book color
mm-hmm.
and the color of it. So when they got through with it, it was immaculate.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of Egyptian people who studied Egyptian art and Egyptian would come in here and study this
yeah.
and say, oh, yes, now you see here on the wall it says this, this, and this, and this. I mean, as if it was an original.
Wow.
I mean, it was that.
Yeah.
It was that good.
Well, it definitely was yeah. a work of art once they were completed with the whole thing. I did not know that it was a group of students. I thought mm-hmm. it was one individual.
It was a group of students who
yeah.
went in and did that. Now,
yeah.
They did the students because they could get it a little bit cheaper.
Sure, of course.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
Now all of that was done through Mark Van Fontenberg. He's the person that directed that whole
mm-hmm.
construction of mm-hmm. the Egyptian period.
Yeah. And again, that it was a story of Cleopatra
yep.
beginning when she was born and coming on the chariot. I mean, according to the Egyptian mythology of how she came about, and then, of course,
yeah.
the with Mark Anthony.
Right,
and
the rise and fall.
Rise yeah. and fall, and mm-hmm. basically being bitten by the asp and then being mm-hmm. carried off and died. And yes,
yeah.
it was along the whole walls. It was phenomenal and remained beautiful until the end for all those.
Still is right now.
Yeah,
if we go over there, it's still just as beautiful as it was.
Yeah, immaculate. Very
yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah.
And then in order to add to this, that I think was really the piece de resistance was the Dr. Albo collection
yes.
that he had given to this. So talk a little bit about some of how that came about and what all he had. Well, donated, basically.
They built three glass cabinets. These were like 8-foot glass cabinets that they built with locking doors. Mm-hmm. And he had donated all of his, not all of it, yeah. but enough to fill up all these cabinets of different props and magic props, old magic props.
Yeah, collectible. P&L.
And P&L, a lot of P&L.
And
Thayer. All of those props were displayed very properly and mm-hmm. had to stay in those positions. Mm-hmm. Could not be moved during cleaning, only to be put right back where they were.
Just went in and dusted from time to time and then put
it
right back.
Went in and dusted it. Could not be moved. All the things that we had
in there.
So that
was all part of the
arrangement. All part of his
arrangement
that he did. And that collection would always stay with the building.
Yes.
Always stay with the building. Now, I don't know, to my personal opinion right now, all that collection is still there.
Okay.
But as far as I know.
Yeah.
It was about a year ago when I went in here.
Now, beyond that, of course, he had posters and everything, too, mm-hmm. that, again, added to the flavor sure. of it being magic throughout mm-hmm. the whole thing. And those were his posters as well?
Those were all the posters of Magic Island, meaning it belonged to
Magic. Oh,
it
belonged to the island.
It belonged to
Did
they
he sell them, or
where
did they come
from? Lee Jacobs. These were all...
So, they weren't all originals.
They weren't all originals, but now there were some that were original that he donated.
Yeah.
There's some of these posters, like maybe 3 or 4 of them were made, and we had about 3 posters that were originals.
Mm-hmm. I know one of the Alexander posters.
Which
was, I know, did I hear Copperfield had come in and offered like $250,000
something,
or something?
I don't know what.
$20,000, I think it
but
was. Just
no one would sell it to him.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. I wish they would have sold it to
him. Now, at this point,
at least we'd know we'd still have it.
That's right.
But I don't know what the outcome was.
And then beyond that, there were other, I think Doug Henning poster were in there and some other things that. I thought that those were all originals because then they opened up that other room back where they'd had a fire, I think, a time or two, that had Levent, I think, from Australia, had several other larger posters. Mm-hmm. Those looked like originals. I didn't know those were.
Now, they could have been. Okay. I just knew that we had those posters, and when we opened that back room up and made it into another banquet room, we had those reframed, had them framed and put in there. Because they were in large sheets in a room that we had downstairs in a storage room. And I wanted to get them up because they weren't doing anybody any good laying down in that storage room.
Right. Now, in addition to that we had Anne White's photos.
Right. Anne White's photos lined the walls where everybody lined up for the shows.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful collection. Almost all of her magazine shots for Genie and Magic and the IBM and Mom, all of her cover shots was on the wall.
Yeah. You had a lot of different sliding doors and things that happened that I remember one particular bookcase that you could break this light or something and it would open, slide, and that would open up another little area, another room.
Well, that took you into the... what they call the Magic Lounge.
Magic Lounge, that was
it. That's where the piano player was.
Yeah.
The problem was is that later, that door moved so slow because by the time you broke the light, you waved your hand over the statue and said the magic word, and the door, library door, would
slide open. Right.
It was too long for the food.
Oh.
The waiters complained about it,
That's
that they had to wait so long for the door to move so slow.
Yeah.
So they began locking the door down, and it was an issue that I wanted them to unlock it to let it be the magic. We need the magic here at Magic Island.
Yeah.
And it was a problem that we always fighting. People were looking to serve the customer first, and and I wanted to keep the decor going, and it was a constant battle.
Now, they had also, you mentioned the psychics. There were always two or three psychics, and they were all different because one was a palm reader, another one was reading colors, another one numbers.
Blue stones and all different types of things.
Yeah. So people can go from one to the other and perhaps get a completely different reading.
Right. Yeah, a lot of good stories on those psychics. I mean to tell
like
you.
What?
All right, I'll tell you one. I get a call from David Ahmed, the general manager, and said, Scott, we're going to need your close-up magicians coming a little early because we have a group that's coming in from a convention center, and they're going to come straight in and have cocktails here.
Yeah.
And so if you guys will just do your stroller magic out in the main lounge, I really appreciate it. So I think I had a couple people there, and we met there, and we're all doing our thing, and people were enjoying it, and it was a bustling crowd because they just come off the golf course. They were still in there. Some of them were in golf clothes.
Golf clothes,
and,
yeah.
And
how many people?
I would say about 75 men.
Okay.
75 men. And all of a sudden, there was this drink that this gentleman was holding in his hand. He threw it to the floor, and it broke to 1,000 pieces.
Holy cow.
And he said, "You witch, get out of here right now," talking to our psychic.
Yes. And he used a witch, not the B word, the W word.
So. He used the W word, witch.
Yeah.
And everybody, the whole room stopped.
Wow.
And being sort of the acting jack in charge, I stepped over and said, "Sir, I'm sorry, but is there a problem?" He said, "Yes, this lady is a witch." And he was screaming at the top of his voice.
Yeah. He wasn't drunk? He was serious?
No, he was serious.
Yeah.
And to make this story a little bit shorter, previously, while the psychic was reading, she said, "You will come into a small amount of money."
Mm-hmm.
"That money is a very large sum of money if you were to sell it. But you will only pay less than $5 for this property." Now, that's way out there, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say
that's
so.
That's way out there.
Yeah.
"And that person that you'll be buying that from is a relative. I'm not sure. It's a real close relative." Mm-hmm. And that's when he threw the glass down. Apparently, about an hour before he arrived at Magic Island, his brother called him and said he was getting a divorce from his wife and he was going to transfer all of his property over to him so that she couldn't get any of that money.
Yeah.
And that he would have to pay for it, and we're going to sell it for $5 to you.
Oh my gosh.
And we'll split the profit later or something like this. So this guy could not believe that our psychic somehow saw that in the runestones that she was reading. And
wow.
Very.
That's pretty specific.
Yeah,
right.
And I said, "Maria, you remember Maria.
Sure.
I said, "Maria, how did you come up with that?" She said, "I don't know. I was trying to come up with something out in left field."
Yeah.
You know? She said, "I didn't know that I struck a nerve."
Boy, she hit a grand slam. It wasn't just left field. Holy moly.
We had another one situation sort of like that while we're talking about psychics.
Yeah.
it was Maria again. Hmm. Maria told this lady that you'll be getting a divorce. And that basically you're going to marry your long-lost love, and you're going to have a child in less than 3 years.
Yeah.
And that was sort of her nut of the prediction that she gave.
Yeah.
The lady said, "You're stupid. You're crazy.
Yeah.
You're out of your mind. One, I love my husband now, and I'm not going to get a divorce."
Right.
"And second of all, I've had an operation where I can't have any more children."
Mm-hmm.
"So this is wrong." So Maria bounced out of it and got out of his best.
Sure,
she could.
Of course.
Well, about 3 years later, this lady came up to the Magic Island front desk and wanted to speak to the psychic.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't let anybody up unless they paid for the show, the meal, and all that.
Right.
So I said, "Ma'am, I'd be more than happy to relay any message to Maria that you'd like, but we just can't let you upstairs." And she says, I said, "What's the message?" She says, "Well, I was here 3 years ago. I did get a divorce from my husband, and I did go back home and married my long high school sweetheart. And guess what?
I am
now pregnant."
Oh, man.
I said, "Hold that thought." So I go upstairs because chills are all over me.
Oh, yeah.
So I get Maria, and I bring Maria. I said, "Maria,
you got to hear this."
She says, "No, I can't. I've got people waiting for me."
Yeah.
So I said, "Let's close it down." I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, if y'all will go over to a close-up room, we'll do a special close-up show for you."
Yeah.
"But Maria, you got to hear this."
Yeah, it's worth
it. So I took it down to Maria, and this lady told Maria, oh, they hugged and they cried and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It was phenomenal. I just don't know how she came out of left field with all that. But those psychics, I don't know if they have it, but they really had it great at Magic Island. They had a great clientele.
Wow, they really did. And I've heard people say before about psychics that, you know, you're going to hit something, you're going to hit, and that if you do enough, as she has done over the years, when you hit, you're going to hit big. Right. And when you lose, you're going to lose big. But
I always said, if I die and come back, I'm going to come back as a psychic.
Yeah.
Because, as you recall, people would line up 10 deep
Oh, sure.
to listen to these psychics.
And they'll wait all night long.
All night long.
Sure.
we'd be closing at 2, and people hated it because they had to go, they hadn't had their reading.
Haven't had a psychic yet, yeah.
And I have a ticket here saying I get a reading.
That's right, they did get tickets, didn't they? I forgot about that.
Mm-hmm. And I've always said, man, popularity.
That's why they had 3 of them, because they were so busy. So busy. I mean, so popular. That's true. Well, even yet today, I still get to occasionally someone saying, I'm trying to get hold of one of the psychics.
I had one last week.
Yeah, did you even still?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. I still have that occasionally. They want to come to a party or something like that.
Sure, yeah. And they remember those in particular from the Cat Island being right on target.
You know? I did a Schlumberger retirement party this past Tuesday.
Yeah.
And half the people there had been to Magic Island
because
it was part of my introduction. And all these people came up and said, oh, we were there for our Christmas party. And it was really wonderful and telling me all the great experiences they had and this. And it's fun time.
Well, the people who had worked there also, as I recall, I think that didn't Harry Blackstone Jr. open on the opening night?
Yeah, it was he was the opening night on both nights. One, when we first originally opened under
Michael Cayley.
And Swartz. And then when Dr. Atari and David Ahmed bought it from Dr. Albo, we had him back. So he was there twice.
A couple times, okay.
Right. And I have a story about Blackstone Jr. Now, I had just gotten or received the title of resident magician in charge of close-up rooms. Bill Arnold, Kent Bingham, myself were the close-up magicians. And it was a thrill to me because, as you remember, back in the 80s, early 80s, 79, you didn't get to meet all the celebrities that were in magic because there was no big lecture tours going on. And you only had the IBM convention, and so on. Ever so often you'd get to meet some of the celebrities. But here I was in a situation to meet all these great celebrities.
Yeah.
And the first night was going to be Blackstone. So we met at our table and had dinner. That solidified our table that night. Because when the person came up, I said, well, we'll sit here at this table, and this will be the magician's table, so if you'll have Mr. Blackstone join us over here.
So that was the first night?
That was the first night.
That's where we
first
always
night.
Met
and
ever since.
And so from that moment on, it became the magician's table. Blackstone came over and joined us and his wife. And we all finished, and he went on backstage to get ready for the first show around 7 o'clock.
Right.
And the three of us, the close-up magicians, all went around to the close-up rooms. And a short minute came by, a little time passed, and Blackstone Jr. came around the corner. Oh, Scott, you know that booming voice
he had.
Yeah. Scott, could you help me here? He says, where is that room that is namesake for my father and my family? I said, room? He says, yes, it's called Blackstone's Corner.
Oh. Okay,
now,
and that's all it was.
That's all it was.
A corner.
And I said, a room, because I kept thinking he meant a room.
A room, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about the bar
where
the magicians hung out between the two close-up rooms called Blackstone's Corner. And when he said Blackstone Room, I thought he was talking about one of our rooms. Well, there's Cleopatra's Chamber, and there's all the different names.
Right.
I went down the list, but there was no Blackstone. And then it hit me. Oh, that's the... And I said, room, oh, my goodness. So I said, Harry, you are in Blackstone's Corner.
Right now.
Right now. And he let out a bunch of curse words about Ye Long.
Yeah, I can hear
and that. Where is Michael Cayley? Get me him right now. Because they had promised him a room with his father's name and his name on the room. It would be dedicated to him because he was one of the consultants on Magic Island,
along with
Siegfried Roy and
Walter Blaney.
Walter Blaney. Yeah. A few of these people were brought out as consultants and was on all the stationery, all of the advertising and all that.
Right.
So, boy, was Blackstone upset.
I did not know that.
Yeah, very upset. Man, he came around there after the show and how embarrassing it was to have just this corner. And I don't blame him because of what they told him he was going to get.
Yeah.
It was going to be a big room and he could have banquet room parties in there.
Right.
And all it was a bar in the corner, as you know.
Yeah.
And
with a sign, neon sign said Blackstone's Corner, basically.
So a little bit later, Michael Cayley was in town, so he came over. And so they agreed that they were going to change Cleopatra's Chamber, which is the parlor show, mm-hmm. would seat 100 people. They were going to change that to Blackstone's Corner.
Okay.
And we would change the bar to Cleopatra's Chamber over here.
Okay.
And that sufficed him. He went ahead and finished his week. Everybody was happy. But that never happened.
Never happened. Yeah.
And I hate to put it like that.
That's
and,
right.
I, and naturally, I don't want to talk about negative situations, but... it was a moment in my life where here I was meeting an idol, Blackstone Jr., screaming at me.
Yes.
It was a fun deal.
I remember him being upset with me once when I had that World's Greatest Magic book that was actually a good autograph book mm-hmm. to have a bunch of people. And I had, of course, Vernon and Slidini and Doug Henning and different people who had signed it. And I went to him to have him sign it. Well, his name wasn't in there. It was his father. It was Senior. Yeah. And he was upset and swore, kind of had a string of expletives also. But he signed it anyhow. And I was, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, I know your dad is dead, but you know, it's having you. And he said, well, it's not me. It's went anyhow. Mm-hmm. But we became friends after that.
Yeah.
He was all, but I've heard his wrath.
You know,
he could be, and most times, always genuinely great guy.
Great guy, wonderful guy.
But he did have a temper that can kind of
and
switch
on. He had a
on.
Big voice.
He did have one of the best voices, I tell you. David Chervet does a great Harry Blackstone and has another great voice.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Wilson up in Wichita, Wichita Falls, Texas here, does a great Blackstone then as well. Both of them have a great stage voice and everything then too. So I know there were several mm-hmm. other people who had come into the island and had performed at various times. I think you had always said that you name anybody and they've been in here. I remember that Lance Burton had come through when he was working on his subtrunk escape with the mask.
The mass sword fight. I call it the sword fight act.
Yes, right.
Because he spent all day long. That was the reason why he came to Magic Island, is because the theater was open to rehearsals all day
all
long.
All day, yeah.
All 7 days. And that's the reason, one of the selling tools that I got so many guys to come in. Because mm-hmm. if they had new material they wanted to work on, they could work on not only on the stage, the actual stage that we're going to be performing on, but they would have the lights and the sound and all of it right there.
Yeah.
One big package. And so a lot of guys did come in just to have the theater to practice. And Lance did that, to practice that switch sword fighting thing.
I remember you telling me that Franz Ferrari wanted to come in, but you were saying, Franz, the video you'd sent me, it was kind of like making the space shuttle disappear or a Mack truck. It's like, what can you do on stage?
All of his stuff was outside, and it wasn't anything that we could have done on the inside. Because I asked him, I said, Franz, what can you do on the stage? Mm-hmm. Because those props are way too big. Well, I'll come there and figure out. I said, well, we got to know before you come.
Yeah.
Because I just can't book you on a whim.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll get back with you. So he didn't realize just the size of our stage.
Yeah.
And that was...
it's more the size of the stage of the Magic Castle,
right.
From that standpoint, with a raked audience, as opposed to it being higher like the castle is, and everybody on the same level where they move the chairs in and out. This was actually theater style seats that were locked
grand
in place.
Theater, and everybody just loved it. And that was one of the things that really made it an attraction for especially rising stars in Magic, guys that were just getting started, guys that wanted to have a good video of their show.
Sure.
All that kind of thing. And you know, we had Kurt Miller, was one of the close-up magicians, and he, for a small fee, would video their act with professional equipment.
Camera.
And it was really a place to come if you were starting out in magic, or even if you had new material that you wanted to break in.
Yeah.
Because you broke it in every night. And five shows a night.
And that was one of the things Jeff said also, as far as the people who are coming in, that this is really not for comedy club magicians doing comedy club kind of things, because that the audience of the Magic Island would think that's silly. And not so much that it's rude, it's just that they were more of a country club rather than a comedy club type of an audience.
Right, very true.
So there were some people that you had to say no to.
There was a lot of guys that I had said no to because of the fact that the tapes that they sent me were risque. And I had those kind of blue material in it. And for some reason, I really didn't like the idea of them coming out impromptu saying, and where are you from? You know, that type of thing.
Exactly,
And so many of the comedy club magicians who were starting out later came in with an act, what I call a magic act. and has done very well.
Yeah.
Jeff Peterson, for an example. Another one is our friend Kerry Pollack.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me tell you about Kerry Pollack. Kerry Pollack, as you know, was up in the Chicago area, and all the magicians that were coming through out of New York, because mm-hmm. I was getting them all out of New York, and some out of California, yeah, because I was in the middle.
He was from Parma, Ohio, actually.
Parma, Ohio. Yeah, yeah. Ohio. And he was playing in a club out there called Poons or Poos or something like that.
Okay.
And everybody, all Joe Monte, Levent, every Vito Lupo,
yeah.
All of them were telling me that this funny guy is the greatest magician in the world. You ought to get him.
Yeah.
And I said, well, okay. But he plays comedy clubs. He MCs out there, and he's a great guy. And so I called him on the phone, and I said, Kerry, I said, I'm Scott Hollingsworth, and I'd like to I've met you. I've heard about you. All the guys we know go out there. And I said, right. I said, how would you like to work for me out here for 2 weeks? Oh, I'd love it, but I don't have any magic. I said, Wait, you don't have any magic. He said, no, I'm a comedy club, just strictly comedy club. I said, well, what do you do in of all the magic you do? Well, I have this plunger stick that I vanish. I said, well, is that it?
Is that all you got?
Is that all you got? And he says, yeah, that's about all the magic I have. Rest of it's all comedy. He says, it's fun. He said, I'm working on a couple of things. I got a card trick called Kate and Edith that I'm working on. He said, but it's not finished. I said, can I call you back? Great.
Yeah.
So I talked to a couple of guys that had been in, and they said, oh, yeah, he's a funny guy. So because at that point in time, I had to go with two acts. One, a bird act or a manip act of 12
silent
to
act.
Silent act for 12 to 15 minutes, and a comedy act that would go for 25 minutes.
Then you'd MC in between.
Then I would MC in between.
Yeah.
So I needed a heavy comedian, but I always was looking for comedy magicians.
Yeah.
And I wanted to stay away from the comedy club comedians.
Right, right.
So, but all the guys had told me what a great guy this is, and this is going to be the funniest show in the world. So I called Kerry back and said, Kerry, do you have any promo pictures you could send me? He says, you going to book me? I said, yep, I sure am. He said, wow. And I said, sure. I said, you send me a promo. So he sent me, I don't know if you know his promotional materials or not, but he has a urinal. A plastic urinal that he's cut out his face and sticks it in it, and that's part of his bathroom magic show.
Yeah.
That was the only picture that he had. So I put it up in the cabinet.
Yeah.
Down in the lobby.
I'm sure Ahmed liked that one.
So David Ahmed came by, the general manager, and says, get me Scott down here right now. What is this? I said, what? And he said, that. I said, well, that's Kerry Pollack. He's a great a comedy magician. And he's going to come in and work 2 weeks for it.
Yeah.
With that, that's an insult to my clients.
Yeah.
If he fails, so go your job.
Okay.
I said, all right.
I'm on the line.
Man, I was sweating bullets. Sure enough, he came in. Nice guy. Wonderful.
Yeah.
I kept thinking, boy, you better be funny. You better keep it clean.
Yeah, yeah.
He killed.
Yeah.
That night, he absolutely killed. That was the funniest
it was
show.
Ahmed
was there. Sitting there like a bull.
With his arms crossed.
Daring me, because he's going to turn around and fire me. That was the opinion that I got from him.
Right.
And it was a great, great show. And I said, whew. But so many of the comedy guys that were wanting to work, they really didn't have enough material to make up a magic show. And our clientele was looking for a magic show.
That's
and not
what
so much.
The sign said, it's Magic Island.
It's Magic Island. So it wasn't looking for the comedy show. And, and a lot of them were blue, and I told them that it wasn't so much that I didn't mind it, because we all go over to Laugh Stop on Sunday night and watch the comedians over there.
Yeah.
But basically, I just had to keep it straight at Magic Island, so that was a problem. So we used other people that were strictly comedy. Like Vince, Comedy Vince, we use those. And probably the best show that I've ever seen in my, comedy show that I've ever seen in my life, magic show, was the pickpocket artist, Ricky Dunn.
Ricky Dunn, yeah.
If somebody ever asked me, what was the best show that you ever had at Magic
What's the best show you've ever had at Magic
Well, I'm glad you asked. The best show was Ricky Dunn. Now, Ricky Dunn did a flat 18-minute show, comedy, he had nothing but a little briefcase, nothing on stage, that he walked out with his pickpocket act. And he basically had a bill, barred a bill, signed initial. It vanished. And then he started the process of looking for the bill.
He had this glass would refill, too.
With he had that as a closure.
Okay.
The gizmo glass.
Gizmo glass, that was it.
Yeah. And he basically would then go through the process of looking for the $100 bill because he didn't have $100, and he had to get the $100 back to the customer. So do you have it, and do you have it, and do you have it, and went through the five guys that were on stage.
Yeah.
And in the process, he stole all their wallets and billfolds and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That was his act in a nutshell.
One
night, we had a company, a big company, come in, and their president of the company was with them.
Right.
Now, he was about a 6'4" guy, about 280 to 350, big guy.
Okay.
I mean, just a really nice dresser. He's a dapper Dan.
Yeah.
He had a vest, a suit coat, tie, suspenders, and you knew he was the man in charge.
He was the
big boss.
Yeah.
So in the process, ladies and gentlemen, straight from the International House of Pancakes, Ricky Dunn.
Yeah.
Ricky Dunn comes right on up, right on the stage, and he does his da-da-da-da-da-da, and gets this guy, brings him up, gets this guy and brings him. Doesn't tell him why he's bringing him up.
Well,
you look good. Boy, you're a handsome guy. Come on up here.
Yeah.
Boy, you know, all the kind of gags. And so he had five guys lined up on the stage.
Yeah.
Well, in the process of starting the big guy, we'll call him Joe, was holding the handkerchief that had the $100 bill in it.
Okay.
And the $100 bill vanished, and it did not appear in the lady's envelope that she had sitting on the front row.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he started accusing the other people of having the bill. So, Joe, do you think this guy, do you know this guy? Well, yeah, he works for me. And so, anyway.
So he goes to the pickpocketing these guys.
Now, in the process, he steals the Joe's big guy, boss, tie, belt, suspenders.
And he didn't know he had it.
Didn't know he had
it. I love
and,
it.
And now these guys, because he was such a big guy, and you know Ricky Dunn was about 5 foot five, 5 foot six.
Short fella.
Little short guy, and little short little arms.
Yeah.
Kind of a
Danny DeVito kind of guy.
Danny DeVito. You have to kind of visualize this little guy and this great big guy, and he was reaching all over the place doing. And so these guys kind of saw him stealing this stuff, and they were just laughing. And then he would go to them and steal their watches and billfolds. And it was a great act, here's where the kicker came. This is what makes this show so good. While he's get to the point of not finding the bill, he looks to the guy, and the guy's pants falls to the floor.
Oh, no.
And there he's standing in his shorts socks pulled up halfway to his knees. The audience, all his employees just go bazonko. And naturally, if this was a time when we had cameras, they would have been taking photos right and left.
Oh, yeah.
It was. And the guy did not realize that his pants had dropped to the floor.
Oh, no way.
No way. He stood up there holding
his pants by his ankles.
Yeah, ankles.
He didn't reach down to grab them.
He's still holding that handkerchief with the bill in it.
Yeah.
And everybody was on the floor. Everybody just, because this prima donna guy, boss of the company, they had never witnessed this kind of thing
Well,
before.
Of course.
Anyways, I got calls for months and months and months after that when we're bringing back Ricky Dunn.
Yeah.
So I kind of consider that moment was a great moment.
Now, what about that guy? I mean, once did he realize when he pulled the pants? I mean, was he upset or?
No,
one
of the employees, I guess it was vice president or something, said, "Hey, won't you pull your pants up?" He said, "Pants." He looked down and he turned around, pulled his pants up, and did all the funny things. But it was a fun deal, and it was one of those kind of things, and that I think it was one of the.
I remember one time there was a fella who used to be the Magic Island photographer also, and he had this magic Polaroid camera, basically. So
Michael?
His name was Michael.
Yeah, Michael. First name is Michael. I can't remember.
And he would take the pictures of people around the island, and it would be superimposed with someone else. So even though Terry Seabrook wasn't there, he'd take a picture of you, and then it would be like standing next to Terry, picking a card or something or whatever.
He had taken these stills and put them in the camera, and somehow he had them in the camera.
Yeah, which was way before Simon. It was a pretty cool little thing.
Right.
Well, I remember him telling me that one of the funniest things. For me also, when I was on stage and performing, and at this time I had a man and a woman up there, and I was using a loda bowl, and I also had a thing in which I had two handkerchiefs. So I would tie together and say, okay, well, they were not tying together, and I had a this is kind of a running gag at the end. It would be like a 20th century silk type of a thing. And then the running gag, of course, with the loda bowl. Well, I had a lady up over there who then was starting to take off her clothes. She would unbutton her blouse. And I said, well, it's not that kind of a show. You know, that's over at Rick's. That's down the street. I said, you know, it's the wrong kind of club that you're thinking of. Well, as I was trying to get her to put her clothes back on, because she'd been drinking, obviously, quite a bit, this other guy was over there starting to dump the water out of my loda bowl. You know, and I come back over and I said, no, put the bowl back down. And as I would start to put that back down, then she'd be starting to undress again. I turned back over to her and said, no, you know, she'd be button that back up. Yeah. He would take my silks and start, you know, and say, hey, look at this. And so, I said, no, put that back down. And it was just back and forth, you know. And it's one of those kinds of things that would be lightning in a bottle that you just can't put back in. You can't never recreate again.
Never really recreate
again. It was so funny at the time. But one of the things also I recall that you said that as far as the magicians that you would hire, you wanted to make sure that they would be appropriate for the kind of country club audience that they had. But also that you'd said that if you were going to be having a magician who would be who would kill every other show or so, as opposed to someone who was steady all and good all the time. You'd rather have somebody who was good all the time.
Right. Steady and solid. That was what I was looking for. I wasn't really looking for the sensational guys because I wanted to have each and every show a positive show. And that's why I wanted them to stay with their show that they were starting with. Now, as far as them changing the show up, I only ask them to put in one or two effects in the middle of their show. Some guys would bring in three shows, and one show would be one show, and then they would rotate their shows.
Yeah.
But it was – what would happen would be is that they would go out into the lounge and say, oh, did you see this guy perform where he cut the girl's head off?
Yeah.
And the people said, no, he didn't do that trick in our show.
Uh-huh.
And they would come back and want to go in that show to see that show.
And there wasn't enough room. Yeah.
And there wasn't enough room. And so I want them to do the same show, except each night. Now, if they want to change up tomorrow night and do a different show, that would be different.
Yeah.
But what I was looking for was the continuity of a solid show, classic, solid show magic.
Yeah.
Now, to you and I and to some of the other guys, it might have been a little boring. But to the lay audience, and that's who I was playing to, it was pure magic. And that's what I wanted them to see was the magic of the classics. And not, I think every new prop in all of magic today that hasn't been out there in the last 10 years, had just come on in the last 10 years, was introduced at Magic Island. I mean, guys, hey, I just bought this from Jim Steinmeier or Daniel
Smith.
Bill Smith just built this for me, and I got to have a place to work on it. And so we got to see a lot of the brand new things that were there.
Yeah.
All of those illusions that they would bring in.
And the audience really got to see a lot of really good stuff. And back in the heyday, I recall, gosh, on New Year's Eve, where there were like 650 people. See, we had, what, 350 a night, pretty much average.
Right. Well, but each theater, each show would hold 150. So it would be easy for us to get 600 people in an evening.
Throughout the evening.
Because the way the shows were and the way the dinners were all set up, it rotated in. So if you had an early dinner, then you'd go to a show. Then after the show, you went to see the parlor show and the close-up shows and the psychics and fun and blackjack and all the other things. So when you came in, you immediately went to the dinner and went right into the theater to see the main show, and then right on out into the other activities that were going on.
Well, that was one of the interesting things also. Unlike the Magic Castle, again, where they have set shows at certain times, this went on as frequently and as often or in often as there were audience or people who were sitting in there. And I remember performing as late as 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Sure.
And I remember Roger Klaus once saying, look, I've done 21 shows. I'm done. You know, that's no more. He was in there working the close-up room, and he said, I'm done. Because he was just doing 10-minute shows, and they were cycling in and out. That was just – and then there was a short period of time in which the island actually kind of closed as the island and became more of a featured for entertainment because, like what's his name? Tiny Tim performed there, Frank Sinatra Jr. For like 6 months, and that didn't work apparently.
We had a a management company come in, and that was before Dr. Albo, Dr. Tari and David Ahmed bought it.
Okay, I thought that was that interim period.
It was right there at that time when Dr. Albo and them were trying to sell it, and they came in with this management company that wanted to try something new. As long as we had solid close-up shows and solid parlor shows, then they would bring in celebrities, music celebrities, singers, like Tiny Tim, and just you name them. We had several of those.
It was kind of a B or C.
B. They were has-beens. I mean, really, they were superstars at one time, but then they kind of faded out.
But had a name to bring in the audience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work at all.
Yeah.
Because once I would step out and ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you very much. Where's the magic? You know, they'd always want to know where the magic was on the stage.
Right.
Because they were it was membership. So they knew the operation of the club better than a lot of us. So they were always wanting to know when Kate Starr went off. And, and I'm trying to think of some of the other people. When they went off, well, where's the magic?
There should be magic after that.
After in the theater. So there were always complaints about that.
Well, then later on, after it did become public, you cut, or the owners took the seats out of Clio.
Right.
Because that, as I understand it, that they were not bringing in additional revenue for two magic shows. There was enough magic going on with the close-up and with the stage, and they could make more money that as a banquet. So they took the rake seats, and they stopped having that as a theater.
Well, that was one of my brainchilds, because they kept wanting me to cut back on the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, what if I put all the stage shows in one room?
Mm-hmm.
Then we could make that room where the parlor show, Cleopatra's Chamber, into a banquet room, and we could sell banquets.
Right.
Well, I sold them on that. My problem is that the acts I needed, 12-minute silent act and a 20 to 25-minute talking show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we made that transition from one stage and two different acts on one stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. The very first night, we booked a $5,000 banquet in Cleopatra's Chamber. And then the next night. And so the next night. So within a month, we had really boosted our revenue from just having that banquet room that we could book 100 people to sit in. That was the problem that we were having, is that a banquet wouldn't go there because they couldn't all sit in the same dining room.
Yeah.
If you recall how it's set up, we had these rooms that would seat 50 over here, 60 over there, 20 over here, and no room that would seat 100. So Cleopatra's Chamber, when we made it into a banquet room rather than a parlor show, it was a salvation.
Yeah. And so then actually, what was the year that it opened?
It actually opened in 83 to private members. Now, what we were doing was bringing private members in and their companies and doing private shows for them. But it didn't actually open until I think it was January the 4th or 5th of 84 that we actually opened the business up. It was shortly after New Year's.
And then, of course, closed in 2008 when we had that Hurricane Ike that had come through all the time. Or that it wasn't so much the hurricane as it was the fire hose that came in, that high-pressure water had kind of caused more water damage than
the
hurricane
The rain, naturally, the roof had opened up and the rains went in, and it all went in the theater area and ruined the seats and the curtains and the flooring.
And just not enough insurance to cover it, I guess.
And the little fire that they had a fire all right, and the firemen came in and did a lot of damage. The neon bulbs that went around the outside edge of the building had the transformer box where the gas and all was in that area. And that is what caught on fire, just the gas.
Yeah.
Well, they put out the fire on the outside, but they came on the inside and began making sure there was no fire inside.
So
and that's where all the water pressure and all the water damage in the fire department.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it certainly was a good run and a lot of fun while we had it. And as you said, just about everybody had come through there and gotten a lot of experience and learned some new stuff. And I know people have looked at that building of trying to reopen it, and there just hasn't been enough money or interest, I guess, to have that. And I don't know that's going to happen. As far as you know, there's, again, all of the items are still inside there. Mm-hmm. And one more thing, when they were building that and some of the artifacts that are still in there, I thought were fantastic because they were some of the movie props, like the bar was from Irma LaDuce. There were some plants that were from the TV series Lost in Space.
Right.
There was a chandelier from Gone with the Wind.
Right.
That was in there.
All that's still there. Yeah. All that is still hanging or still in there. And they're trying to keep it in good shape. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what their plans are.
Yeah.
And I don't really think they do. I think Dr. Tari's biggest concern is keeping the property for the right buyer to come by and him selling that entire block. You know, he owns the old small store and the MIR clinic and the other little small building. So he owns a big piece of property along there.
I see, that's a pretty prime property.
Very prime property, and it would be great for a high-rise office building.
Yeah, probably what will happen, unfortunately.
Unfortunate.
And so with these Dr. Albo props and other things that are in there then right now that go with the building, once the building goes, that will go with the owner, and maybe they will sell that off or whatever, I guess, at some point. And so maybe watch for an auction.
Well, I'd mentioned to them that if they decide that they're going to tear the building down, that would they please call me, and I'll have all the magicians in town come
give
out
them
there,
my backup name, just in case you're not around or that you're an invalid.
And we basically would all come out and load all that in our pickup trucks and get it out of there. Yeah. And so that way they wouldn't have to bother with it.
Sure, might not bother with that.
I hope and pray. But it was a good run. It was a great time, and it was good for me. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think about it quite a bit, and I get a lot of calls from a lot of the guys that are still personal friends of mine. That they're out working cruise ships. And
well, that was one of the things towards the end, of course, that the guys who were working, it was mainly cruise ship magicians, because you said you had a silent act, then really more of a furniture act, and then had a comedy magician, talking act. And then you kind of, again, cutting back on the budget, so this way that you would then have just the one act, and that a cruise ship guy could kind of do it all.
Right.
Now, one of the things, too, is that in addition to the salary and the meals, that they got a room, which in the early days of the castle, that didn't include your lodging, but you always had a condo where they could stay.
Yeah, in the very beginning, we stayed at the Holiday Inn that on South Main
downtown,
Street.
Yeah.
And then basically that gave up when they sold that hotel, and then we were able to get a small apartment project right around the corner from Magic Island. And we had two apartments there, and we were able to give the acts free 2-week rent, and there was no charge for the staying there. And they could eat at nighttime at Magic Island. And I had, in the very beginning, it was travel. I gave travel. If the airport plane said $300 or whatever it might be, I would give them $300 if they drove in or if they flew in, whatever they wanted to do. But whatever that fee was, that would be their travel expenses.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys would drive in. And a lot of guys would just make a little money on the travel.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a good place to learn because you could set your props up, leave them in there, and rehearse all day.
That's right.
And then at nighttime, step right there on stage.
And do show after show.
Show after show.
You know, I thought it interesting, too, again, because the castle would say that you have to do these shows at certain times, and at the island, that the contract was for X number of shows throughout the 7-day period of 1-week engagement. Mm-hmm. So you may do 24 shows, but you may do all of them within 2 nights.
Right.
Before that you actually kicked into starting to get the extra pay.
Extra,
so they may call and say, well, there's no show Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, maybe even Thursday night or whatever. But then all of a sudden Friday, Saturday, it's just booked solid.
Well, that was one of the things that as the entertainment director, I sort of grew with helping the acts develop because I had to have acts and I had to have material. First, we started off with one show in the main room and one show in the parlor room. Later, we combined the two theaters into one show. And then as time went on, I now took out one of those acts and brought in a person that could do 45 minutes.
Right.
So some of these guys that had a bird act didn't have any illusions in the show.
Right.
And then some of the comedy guys could go 30 minutes, but they couldn't go 45.
Right.
So some of them learned to stretch their material. Some of them learned to add another person to the show. Right. So it became a learning curve.
It was very much a learning place. It was a college mm-hmm. for magicians, and right. I learned so much, and I have so much to thank you for as a director there, that you would see these shows night after night and show mm-hmm. after show, and you would give advice. And again, speaking from my personal experience, mm-hmm. I can relate that to other magicians. I'm sure you shared your ideas. For an example, mm-hmm. you were saying, okay, you've tried these jokes, and this just doesn't work. I think if you right. tighten it up and get rid of this, this, and this, mm-hmm. and when you're yeah. standing here, look at the audience. Don't be, you know, right. swaying back and forth, or, you know, just the blocking, the choreography, and, right. the, and the little things. I mean, you've always been just a great coach.
You the know? Details is what makes the show.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And you can tell, where as you knew, I always stood in back of the theater yeah. At the rail, back in the back, because I never knew when I would have to go around to a close-up room or have to go right. out the door. So I was stood up back here, and I could always tell when something wasn't working mm-hmm. because the backs of the heads, and that's what I was looking at the audience
yeah.
and looking towards the stage,
yeah.
whenever the heads started turning and talking to each other.
They weren't paying attention.
They weren't paying attention.
Yeah.
He had lost interest in what he was doing.
Yeah.
So that was one of the assets that I had in being able to work with a guy and say, hey, at this point, we need to tighten this up.
Mm-hmm.
You're too much verbiage, too much movement, not enough action. Mm-hmm. So something's got to be
right.
tightened up in that area. So by me being a back aisle coach, it really helped a lot of guys.
Well, another thing along that line, that it wasn't just us, but also the audience, which you can mm-hmm. say it wasn't you, it was the audience. Because mm-hmm. Years ago I used to do a rock and a shoe, and you always said to me, if they don't laugh when that rock falls out of your shoe, it's the audience, it's not you.
It's not you. Yeah, you're right. Because that is a funny situation.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of times when a person would move, mm-hmm. or do it too quick, not in your case, but somebody would do something else and do it too quick, and the audience didn't have time to respond to it.
Yeah.
But when you held that shoe up and that rock hit the floor, that's a funny bit.
Yeah.
And if they didn't get a response off that, or a gasp or a laugh or, you know, whatever it might be, then you knew that it was the audience. I knew right. that it was the audience.
Right.
But by having that, back to that solid show night after night, mm-hmm. and you did solid magic, then I was always assured that it was going to be
right.
a great show. Sometimes we had bad audiences.
Yeah.
Because some of the audience didn't speak English.
That's,
you know, where you
I
might
know.
Have
yeah.
that.
Right.
And it could always be that situation.
Right. Well, as we wrap up, and I appreciate sure. your time over here, you are able to coach and direct,
sure.
and you have a website. I know we had Bob Fitch on a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm. sure.
and he does workshops, and he teaches magicians how to improve, and I know that you do that as well. How can people get in touch with you in order to, perhaps, if they want to get some personal instruction, coach?
Well, the website, the Magician's Coach, I changed a little bit because I no longer have Magic Island to work at, so mm-hmm. I was bringing guys in and working with them during the day at Magic Island. So the best way to get in touch with me is my website, scotthollingsworth.com.
Okay.
And that way, just go to the contact page, send me a note,
okay.
and I'll get back with you on the phone, and
okay.
we'll talk about something.
Excellent. And then again, to wrap up, because the podcast is called the Magic Word Podcast, what would mm-hmm. be your philosophy of life? What is it that your magic word? What's important to you?
Consistency.
Oh.
I think that once we develop something,
yeah.
it never gets good until we do it and do it over and over, until we know that particular routine or that particular item that you're working on,
mm-hmm.
until you know it inside and out.
Yeah, consistency.
So consistency. It is, I think, is the key to all of our success. You know, if you look at all the great magicians, and I'm going to refer to that since this is a magic pod type of casting, that magicians always need to look at, if they're going to be in magic, always do our best. And the only way to do the best is to do it over and over until it becomes part of you.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, Scott, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
You have been just a wonderful guest, and I think people will get a real sense of history and learn more about the Magic Island, also some of the great stories you told about that then as well, and perhaps will be consistent in their magic in the future.
Well,
then too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Scott Hollingsworth, and this is Scotty out.
I want to again thank Scott Hollingsworth for being my guest here on the Magic Word Podcast, and I know he had a lot more stories. We had gone on for a little over an hour, and I got the feeling that he could probably talk for at least another hour or longer. In fact, later we were chatting, and he was saying, I thought you were going to ask me about how I got around to booking the acts, or that is, how I actually booked the acts, and what procedure that I used, and what I was looking for. Well, that might be fodder for another podcast in the future, if you guys would like to hear more from Scott Hollingsworth. I'll only know that if you're able to post some comments on this blog on themagicwordpodcast.com, or perhaps through Facebook or email. You can contact me all different kinds of ways. What? You're not a friend already and you haven't liked us on the Facebook? Well, go to facebook.com/themagicwordpodcast and like our page. That way you can kind of follow us and see what's going on, as well as, of course, on Twitter at magicwordpod. And on Instagram, it's Scott Wells Magic. And there are lots of different ways to contact us. Of course, you can always get hold of me by email if you want to drop me a personal message, scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. All pretty easy. So I hope that you join the discussion. And again, if you like this one and want to hear more, then let me know. And we'll get back together with Scott and give you a part deux, what he has to say about how he booked acts and what an agent would be looking for whenever that they want to book a quality act. So thank you guys again very much for listening to the Magic Word Podcast. Thanks for your support. And I want to again especially thank the friends of the Magic Word who pledged their financial support to help make this podcast free for the rest of the world to hear. So until next time, stay well, get booked, and mecha leka hi, mecha hiney ho. This is Scotty out.